The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
Welcome to the EMS Educast at EMS Today Conference in Baltimore. We're broadcasting from the ProMed Network studio, which today is sponsored by the Medtronic Foundation. And this episode is also very kindly presented by the Medtronic Foundation. So a big thanks to them for sponsorship of this episode as well as the studio today. I'm Greg Fries, one of the regular co-hosts of the EMS Educast, and so glad to be joined by my good friend Rob Theriault. Rob, hello.
Hello, Rob Theriault from Ontario.
Always great to have you. Again, we did an episode yesterday, and Rob and I are, I guess, just meeting for just the third time in person, but second time doing episodes live face-to-face. Does it feel any different to do it face-to-face?
I love it face-to-face because the flow is a little easier than doing it on Skype.
Okay. I'm trying not to editorialize what he just said, but a lot of things race through my mind. We're really fortunate to have two great guests today, Dan Limmer and Joe Mistovich. Dan has been on the Educast before. Dan, welcome back, but your first live show. How are you? Wait, I take that back. You've done live shows with us before at another EMS conference.
Yes, another EMS conference.
Dan, maybe just a brief introduction for any of our live studio listeners as well as our audience on the World Wide Web.
Thank you. It's great to be here. And before I do, congratulations on your award. You put a lot of work into that. I just wanted to congratulate you while we're here live.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm Dan Limmer. I've had the good fortune to be in EMS now about 33 years. I've been a paramedic for a majority of those times, an educator for a majority of that time as well. I've had several books published through Brady. My emergency care EMT textbook is probably one of the most well-known ones. Joe and I have several projects together, one of which we're going to talk about today. And also I've got an exciting new gig doing review apps for iPhones. And just this weekend we launched live review seminars. We just announced that, so doing lots of fun things. Thank you.
When you say we, what's the name of that app review?
The app review is EMT Review and Paramedic Review and EMT Review Seminars.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Is that an Apple app as well as an Android app?
It is both.
Excellent.
And just to Dan's right, if you're looking at us on the live web stream, is Joe Mistovich. Joe, welcome to the EMS Educast.
Thank you.
Maybe introduce yourself just to get us started.
Sure. I'm Joe Mistovich. I'm from Youngstown, Ohio. Actually a professor at Youngstown State University. Been there 26 years. My 26th year in EMS education. Like Dan, I started in 1981 as a paramedic. So I've been out there a few years. Like Dan, I also have some textbooks out there, and we've done several projects together, and MPACT is one. And matter of fact, MPACT was our original idea years ago, trying to fit the need for assessing the medical patient. So
great.
We're excited to talk about that today.
And we'll dig into MPACT in a little bit. I should just tell the audience that just off stage, I guess, is that stage right over there, is noted EMS educator Bob Page is emceeing some sort of EMS cook-off where the competitors have been assigned a set of ingredients, kind of Iron Chef style, and now they're cooking a meal, and our good friend Chris Montero is in view holding a sharp knife, and be careful. Hopefully he won't need any first aid. So that's going on off to the side.
Where would he get that here?
Yeah, where would he get first
imagine.
Aid? And maybe they'll bring over something for us to test at the end, a lunch, if you will. I wanted to first mention, I'll just hold this up for the camera, this is the CDC Field Triage Academic and Trade Media Kit. And for a couple of years now, the CDC has been leading an effort around a field triage scheme for major trauma patients to help get them to the right trauma treatment destination. And Dan and Joe, I know you both attended a CDC event here at EMS Today related to this, and maybe you could just fill us in on what happened at that event and some of the things you learned.
Well, I mean, I think that one of the big things that the event did is it really put a face on what the CDC is doing. The trauma triage protocols itself, I think, are very, very important, because what they do is they take away some of the importance of mechanism of injury. There's never been science behind mechanism of injury being definitive as far as injury. And what it does, I think, is it not only demotes the importance of mechanism of injury, but it increases other real criteria and actually lets EMS people get the right facts and make a decision. I think it's really a important thing for EMS. I think, like many things we see now, it's growth. Science is coming in. And the other thing I'll say is that putting a face on CDC doing this was fascinating, because Dr. Hunt, who had been part of the EMS Journal Club many of us subscribed to for years, is really, you know, leading that part of the organization. So this is a very nice and friendly EMS thing, and it's important. And I was very pleased to see the CDC doing this for EMS.
Did you get a sense, because they've been at this for a couple of years, if the implementation's been successful, Joe, and where they're sort of at in this process?
I'm not sure. The implementation has been successful. I'm not sure how successful it's been, and I think Dan and I, one of our goals is to really take this message out. As Dan said, this is actually, I was so excited when these guidelines came out, because they really addressed the physiologic parameters, the anatomic parameters, prior to looking just at mechanism of injury. So I think what it does is it's going to change education and how we are educating EMTs, advanced EMTs, and paramedics, because what we're going to cause them to do is focus on the patient. You know, one thing we've been pushing for years is, you know, your patient rolls their car 14 times, they're standing on this curb smoking a cigarette, you don't need to call a helicopter or take them to a level one trauma center. But what Dan was saying, well, what was our number one criteria? It was, well, mechanism of injury. That has changed. Now we're saying, look at your patient to make your decision. So to me, this is earth-shattering. It's the way we need to be going. As far as implementation, the CDC, and one reason why they're here, is actually to really push this program and to educate the EMS providers. Dan and I, and all of our latest editions of any of our books that deal with trauma, those guidelines are published in there. And one thing that we did learn there, this is a free product. Right. It is not copyrighted. It is the public's product. It's paid by taxpayers' dollars. And one thing that Dr. Hunt said was, use it, publish it, present it, write it, whatever you want to do with it, you own it. And I think that's important also for EMS educators and even people at their station who want to do a little continuing ed, is that this is free material to them. So I think we're in the beginning stages of implementation. I think we have a lot more work to do, and I think that's why they're here. And we as educators, and you also in your position, have to take this message out.
And based on your first impressions, is it a simpler triage system, comparatively speaking?
It is. I think it's extremely simple to understand. And again, what's interesting about it is, for the seasoned paramedic, the seasoned EMT, the seasoned advanced EMT, the experienced person, after we got through the drama of the mechanism of injury, this is what we really looked at. And we said the patient's really injured or they're not injured. This one needs to go. This one doesn't need to go. So I think what it really, really did was it kind of focused what the experienced people do right now.
It really gives a chance for several things, like I said, for people to make decisions based on real things, to bring science involved to this. And just one other thing, the telemetry data, that the way they're using telemetry data from vehicles. Now, everyone thinks, you know, OnStar, but other people have those. The one thing that I was probably most interested in there, and how fascinating it was the correlation of the mechanical telemetry data with actual injury severity scores that was put up there. It was fascinating, that material.
Okay. Interesting. I wonder, any discussion about how soon that telemetry data will be available for first responders on the scene?
It's out there already, and especially in Canada. Apparently, Canada is doing a lot of this. You look shocked.
That's
right. Well, it actually, what I have read, and I, you know, I would encourage people to go to the CDC website,
which I've got right here. It's cdc.gov/field-triage, all one word.
And they have the material there. I would encourage people to get the MM. WR report that deals with this because it explains this. But apparently in Canada, they're already using this information, and there's like millions of people that have this information available. I think we're lagging behind here. But the thing that we talked with Dr. Hunt about is we said, you know, when you're getting dispatched to a call, and now the dispatcher is saying the vehicle is going 23 miles an hour, the collision occurred here, the airbag deployed, there was a force change here, and so forth. That's information that I'm sure that the EMT and paramedic and the ambulance, when they're putting their gloves on and so forth, is not going to process. But as Dan said, to have an injury severity score saying, based on this telemetry data, the predicted injury severity score is this, is so important.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable, yeah. the potential for that, because at least it takes this documented scale, this score. Now, we're not really big on the injury severity score in EMS. In research, it's big. You know, we're Glasgow Coma Score, Trauma Score. That's fine. But the injury severity score and this correlation, I think, is really exciting. I think right now, these companies do have some of that information, but the way it's relayed isn't always consistent. And I think that's where the growth area can be.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how much is actually relayed, though, to go back to your question, how much is really relayed to the dispatcher, and if the dispatcher actually at this point does anything with it. And I'd probably venture to say that they don't.
Right.
Huh. Interesting.
Well, thanks for sharing your experience of attending that event. And just remind listeners that you can go to cdc.gov/field triage and find both the MMWR report, the instruction materials, and all sorts of resources from the CDC. And I just my final thought on this maybe has to do with, I think that field triage, that sometimes people hear that label and think about mass casualty triage. And this is really aimed at a major trauma patient. Maybe there's multiple major trauma patients, but trying to get that major trauma patient to the right treatment destination. Did that confusion come up at all as far as like their work to implement this?
Yeah, it did, and they actually addressed that, and they made it very clear that this is designed to be used on an everyday basis for that trauma patient, the perceived trauma patient. It is not a mass casualty scheme. Those are out there. This is not designed for that.
And ultimately, the correct transport decision is the end result they're looking for.
Right.
And they've said that transport decision, as I recall, that transport to a designated trauma center, where they say 25% increase in survivability by going to a trauma center. So, I mean, they're really finding numbers that support this. I think it's exciting stuff.
Oh, it's extremely exciting for EMS. And the thing is, EMS now has to embrace this.
Right.
They got to read about it. They have to implement it. But it is absolutely the right thing for EMS.
Well, and I think especially applicable, like Dan and Robin, myself, I'm not sure about Youngstown, but we are all from fairly rural areas where that transport decision to maybe bypass the closest hospital to just go straight to the major regional trauma center is really important, because if you make a stop at a small local hospital, the patient loses a lot of time that could be spent with definitive care.
And these, of course, you know, they acknowledge that they actually studied states to see if the states in their statewide protocols embrace these same concepts, because really in developing state protocols or regional protocols, which is really what the foundation of our decision making is our protocols, using this as a guideline for the development of protocols is also very important, I think.
Well, let's wrap that up, and just to remind listeners that we're in the Medtronic Foundation podcast studio at EMS Today, and this is an episode of the EMS Educast that's being sponsored by the Medtronic Foundation. We certainly appreciate their support. The next topic I want to go to Dan and Joe is just to introduce the new MPACT program and talk about the work that you're doing on that. So I know there's just been a sort of start of press releases about the program, but maybe first just answer our basic question of what is it?
The MPACT stands for Emergency Medical Patient Assessment, Care, and Transport. And this is what I would call probably the second generation of the AMLS book. I think the way to start is with a little bit of brief history. Joe and I were at a conference in Salt Lake City many years ago, sometime in the 90s. And we were talking, you do an EMS conference, Joey still talk about EMS stuff sometimes. And we said, why is there no course for medical emergencies, no alphabet course? You know, there's trauma courses and there's all pediatric courses. Why is there no medical emergency, the most important part? And this is important stuff. Medical emergencies people think about as routine. Why is there nothing about decision making and diagnosis and the things need to be done? Our publisher at the time happened to be there at the end of this conversation and gave us the challenge, we'll write the book. So we wrote the book, which we called Advanced Medical Life Support. We went to the NAEMT, and they did a course on this. Subsequently, we have separated from NAEMT and now have a separate product. So the MPACT book you see is actually by the original AMLS authors and uses a lot of that philosophy. And that philosophy is the possibilities to probabilities, differential diagnosis, and thinking. It's when you get in the medical patient, it's more about getting the right information and the right diagnosis to do the treatment. Really, most of the important stuff is front-loaded. The treatment is actually much more easy, but it's getting to the right decision. It's about differential diagnosis. And I think this is the part where Joe normally takes over and says some more stuff, and we talk about that, because that's really the big theory. It's about thinking. It's not about treatment. It's about making it a thinking, diagnostic process. There were times, we became paramedics the same year, we weren't allowed to say that we made a diagnosis. But now that our toolbox is so big as pre-hospital providers, you really have to make a diagnosis to figure out which tool, which modality, which medication you're going to use, and that's really the crux of this course.
And I think when you look at this and you say, you know, we looked at all the alphabet courses, and we said, oh, there's all these on trauma and so forth. Trauma is pretty black and white. And I think what we found is that medical, which we deal with on the most regular basis, is the patient who's gray. You know, those are the patients that take the most, they're the most difficult to try to come up with what is the probability, what is the condition they're actually experiencing or suffering from. And so that was the philosophy behind this course. What, as Dan said, what we really, really use is an assessment-based approach. We don't say asthma. Pathophys assessment. We say, here's a patient who has a complaint of respiratory distress or a complaint of dyspnea. Take the blinders off and let's look at all these conditions that may cause a patient to complain of dyspnea, chest discomfort. You know, I think the problem is you see a lot of, and this is interesting, you see a lot of new providers and a lot of very experienced providers, when they get dispatched for a chest pain, they put the blinders on and they say, oh, go into another MI. And they forget about all these other conditions. So what this course is, it's the beauty of the course is for the new paramedic or advanced level provider, it actually opens their eyes to all these possible conditions that they probably didn't think of because they're just trying to figure out what am I going to, and chest pain usually is MI. The experienced provider, because they become somewhat complacent, we've both been there, and you go another MI, it forces them to take the blinders off and think of all the conditions. And as Dan said, we teach them this critical thinking process, and it's basically a rule-in, rule-out process. They take all their history information, they take all their physical assessment information, and they use it and process it, and then they rule in and rule out what the possible conditions may be. And I have to give him credit, and I said that I always would. It was Mike Jacobs years ago that we were talking at a conference, and Mike had this, he's like, and he was all excited about saying, well, you know, basically what we do is we go from possibilities to probabilities. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's it. That's what we do. We take and we start out with all these possibilities from this patient complaint, and we continue to whittle it down to a probability, maybe two probabilities. We maybe never get to the differential diagnosis, but we use the history and physical assessment information to get there. This course and this book is designed to take the reader and the course participant down to that process. How to work through that process is basically what it's designed to do.
I apologize. I continue to be distracted both visually and with my belly and my nose of the cook-off that's going on just to our right. But it looks like Carissa O'Brien and Chris Montero are silently but quickly preparing just an outstanding meal for Rob and I later, maybe. So go ahead, Rob. So
when we think about the trauma courses, there are clinical markers in the primary survey that tell us it's load and go or we have a little more time at hand. In the impact course, do you look at clinical markers? Presumably there's some in the primary survey, obviously, but in the secondary survey, are there clinical markers that you use to determine what's benign, what's life-threatening?
That's a great question. And the first thing, we have to make sure that we will talk about the course as well. You mentioned the course. And the course and the book do use that. We had, in the original editions, and as we continued on, had indicators of clinical instability. Because while the book talks a lot about differential diagnosis, the possibilities, the probabilities, it also takes the stand that you're not doing any of that stuff until life threats are assessed. And while in trauma that's very clear, it wasn't until relatively recently in EMS that we realized time is myocardium or time is brain tissue, and that there are certain things in medical that are now not stay on the scene medical things. So the book certainly does look at signs of instability, and there are specific things. And those instabilities must be corrected before you get into that serious stuff. So that's actually a very core part of the course.
Yeah, and I think one thing to clarify, too, is, and I had mentioned earlier that it's an assessment-based approach. It's an assessment-based approach that moves you, as Dan's saying initially, we know this. As experienced providers, if you walk into a scene and your patient is having respiratory distress, and you look at them and you say, oh, no, no, this is not respiratory distress, this is respiratory failure, regardless of the condition, whether it's asthma, pneumonia, pulmonary edema, pneumothorax, it doesn't matter, the first thing we're going to do is ventilate. Mm-hmm. And so and this whole approach is to take that participant through that and say, the first thing you're going to do, regardless of the condition, is manage the life threats. And those are the critical findings that we actually have in there. Once you work through that and you've managed those and you have moved through, so you could say that they're physiologically stable at this point, now you move from that assessment-based approach into the more diagnostic-based approach. And so it is a mix of assessment-based, moving that reader and so forth into the diagnostic-based approach. And I think that's what we're trying to really push in this, too, is initially it's assessment-based, and then you move them to diagnostic.
And it's interesting that even students as well as experienced providers both benefit from that. You don't always get that in the beginning. You don't get that leaving class really until you're in the field a while. And this would help both of those groups of people.
So what's the course going to look like?
The course, which is created and held through the San Francisco Paramedic Association, and I will say they did a beautiful job putting the course together. The slides, some of the things I've seen in the slides, what they created, the concept is you get a differential diagnosis, you have a chest pain patient, and you say, well, could this be MI? And the slides, using a why or why not, help the student actually think about the concept of differential diagnosis, which is ultimately ruling something in or ruling something out, and it's very sharp. And the other thing that happens is that the course has a very high-level discussion base that's very modifiable. Because what happened traditionally in the old courses is everybody would schlep in all the monitors and all the bags and everything else, and people would really just sit there and talk about it anyways and work through the scenario. So I think one of the really brilliant things they did was, instead of trying to pretend it was something else, they harnessed the power of learning through discussion and self-discovery and the group talking. They've created some excellent scenarios and some great material to guide the instructors to help through and do that. And so we're really very excited about the course and what the SFPA brings into that.
I've got a question, more of the big picture of teaching certification courses, and you guys are both book authors, and as I've taken certification courses or even taught some, oftentimes the instructors really struggle of, like, how do we integrate the actual book into this process? A lot of people go through certification courses, and at the end of it, their book is still in the cellophane, or they say, oh, we'll just buy one book for the class, and if you need it, it's back there under that stuff.
Well, we of course, believe our book is wonderful,
right.
And then who wouldn't want to open it? No, seriously. Let me just talk from the author standpoint. We talk about the book. Let me talk about the table of contents and the benefits that you find in the book, because we've changed some of the approach to that. We actually have a separate chapter on the critical thinking process, which Twink Dalton and I did. Twink, I believe, is really one of the premier critical thinkers in EMS and always has been. She's just a brilliant woman who we're thrilled to work with. I mean, Howie Werman is a doc. It just gets it. He's an amazing man. So there are things in the book that are going to help the thinking process, like the critical thinking chapter. We changed the airway chapter from just airway to managing the difficult airway. So we tried to make it so it was very relevant to try and make it that way for the course. This book is not going through and repeating your paramedic book or your intermediate book or anything else you've done. The book really takes you through the thought process that you need to learn and do that. So we believe the book is a vibrant accompanying this. And quite frankly, it's been our experience with our old book, and we expect it to continue. And we would love people to take the class, but it's been our experience. People even use the book as part of their paramedic class, just as supplemental text, to help their students get those points that aren't in the more traditional presentation of the textbook This gives it more insight rather than presenting didactic material. And I think that insight is the strength.
So I haven't seen the book, but presumably it's written on the assumption that people coming into the course already have the anatomy, physiology, pathophysiology.
Right. Yes.
So it's really aimed at the clinical picture, the case studies.
I think what it's aimed at, and it's kind of interesting because I agree with you, that a lot of times these people buy a book, go through the course, and they're spoon-fed the information that the course wants them to know.
Right.
This is not that way. You have to be prepared walking into the course, because what the course is going to force you to do is use a critical thinking process, use your foundation of anatomy, physiology, and pathophysiology to be engaged in the entire course. If you haven't read the book, or if you don't have a really solid foundation of pathophys and physiology, you're not going to do well in the course. And so realistically, the course is designed to apply what's in the book. And so if you don't read that material and you can't explain the pathophys behind these signs and symptoms and conditions, the course is going to be a lot less meaningful to you.
Joe's right. The pathophysiology is really the key. That we talk about the initial life threats, and we get into the pathophysiology. It's the difference as an educator. And we talked about this last time we were together. There's a difference between learning a list of signs and symptoms for asthma and chronic bronchitis and emphysema versus understanding the pathophysiology of why and then understanding why the signs and symptoms are there. And that is the approach of the book, is somewhat pathophysiology-based, which is different than a lot of other ways people learn.
I get it with your book, but can you maybe, you're both experienced educators and have taught other certification courses, but you know, what is the sort of the bigger picture for educators to integrate any certification? Is it a failing in the books, or is it a shortcoming in the educator, or do we feel like, well, we'll make sure we give them the little tidbits that might have been in the book during the class so they can pass the test?
Writing textbooks often becomes a very linear concept.
Right.
That when people first learn the material, it's very difficult for people not to learn from going from point A to point B or memorizing this and memorizing that. I think that this provides a certain amount of integration. And not that traditional textbooks don't, but it's very linearly presented. I think this is presented in a different way, and I think that will help in the class. As far as how it's actually used, I would recommend a paramedic educator to assign readings from this book in class in addition to whatever textbook they're using, because I believe it will help people get insights into what they're learning. If they're learning, you know, cardiology, if they're learning altered mental status, and hopefully classes are presented that way, complaint-based, and then you work from there, I think this will help supplement that. The other challenge has always been is that a lot of times these courses are used as capstone classes. You finish your course, you know, April 15th, and then for 2 weeks you take every alphabet course in the world. And sometimes that's okay to, you know, to do that. Other times you take it and you take the MPAC class as part of your paramedic education going right through and integrate it. I personally think getting away from that linear education like we talked about last time and integrating the thinking and pathophysiology with the lesson is better education. And I believe our product would certainly help do that, but it's not the tradition.
I would agree. It's a constructivist approach. It's, you know, how do we deconstruct what we see and instinctively know in the field and enable the students to construct their own knowledge? And I think that's the right approach is through critical thinking.
I think one thing you found, too, and to answer the question about the courses and the courses that basically were, you know, students take, like the ITLS or PHLS and so forth, I think what happens there is the students find that they're presented that material, and what they're finding, it's a replication of that material. Because what people have done, and authors have done, and educators have done, and you've done this yourself. So when the first trauma courses came out, eventually what did you do? You started presenting that information as part of your regular curriculum. And so then when they took the course, they're sitting there going, but we already had all this. We had all this. Because it was really material-based. We're spoon-feeding you this material. The difference with this MPAC is, as Dan said, and I could tell you from our own experiences, we use it as a capstone course at the end of our program. And it's not that we're replicating the material that they were taught. We are now trying to teach them a thinking process. I think we all would face it, and we would agree that most EMS education is still very diagnostic-based. When students walk in that day, today we're going to talk about pulmonary conditions, and you go through a series of respiratory or pulmonary conditions that they may experience in the field, pathophys, assessment, management. Here's this condition, pathophys. And then they walk out going, oh, okay, we learned 15 conditions today. But we never actually taught them how to approach a patient experiencing one of those conditions. And what if they're having two? Or maybe it's not that one. And so what this really does is this course is not to spoon feed them information, but it does provide them with a great base and foundation of pathophysiology to figure things out. So when they're processing that information, when they're looking at warm, flush skin, they're going, oh, that's vasodilation. Well, why are they vasodilated? Well, what is triggering the parasympathetic nervous system? I mean, and that's the pathophys part. But it's really to teach them how to think to go from possibilities to probabilities.
Maybe just to wrap up this segment, you can remind people where they can find more information about the MPEC program, and then we'll need at least one of you to rotate out because we've got another guest in the that we're going to bring out. But
of course, the book Impact Emergency Medical Patient Assessment, Care, and Transport is published through Brady. Getting the book itself through BradyBooks.com or your Brady sales rep is the way to go to pick up the book. It is expected to be out May 1. It's on its way to the printer, and we're looking forward to having it out. The San Francisco Paramedic Association is currently looking for sites to be able to host courses to learn how to do it. SFPAonline.org, I believe, is the website for the Paramedic Association. And again, we're thrilled with their course.
We'll do our best to get those into the show notes. Dan and Joe, thanks so much for joining us. And hopefully Jamie Davis can help move Tim Phelan up towards the front table. But
great to be here. Thank you.
Or both of you want to stay, you're welcome to.
Tim is going to take up both chairs.
That's right.
He's that big with things.
And
so.
He is that dynamic. So
I'd sit next
to
Tim. Ooh.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Right. So we'll just have a little pause here while we rotate guests. Okay, after that little pause, we're going to get back in gear here. We had a little guest switcheroo. On these live shows, I usually like to bring in a bunch of different people. And Tim Phelan should be able to hear us now. Tim, talk right close to that microphone in front of me.
Okay. Is that close enough?
No, you got to be right on top of it, uncomfortably close. There
you
go.
There's my radio voice.
Wonderful. Tim, is this your first time on the EMS Educast? I think it is.
I did an interview with Jamie last EMS today.
Okay.
And that's my beginning. That's the sum total of all my experience at this.
Well, wonderful. We know each other, Greg Freese and Rob Terrio, who just introduced himself quickly. We have some people watching us live here live, but people live watching us on the internet, and then we'll also add this to the podcast archive. So maybe you could just introduce yourself quickly for our listeners.
Sure. Well, what I tell folks is I've avoided a real job for 15 years. By what I get to do is just go from place to place and talk peer to peer about 12 lead ECGs, and in the early days it was kind of more about convincing people that maybe this isn't a bad thing. And then as the thing progressed, they wanted some initial education, and we gave them that. And then as people get more and more sophisticated, now we're spending a little more time doing some more advanced topics. So,
okay. So Tim, the advent of STEMI programs must have been very exciting for you.
Absolutely. It was funny. It was indeed very exciting. It was one of those things that all of a sudden it's like the whole world woke up. I mean, it's not like I invented it or anything, but, you know, lots have been done, and we've been talking about it for 7-8 years. And boy, as soon as they coined that phrase STEMI, and then they put pay for performance in there, all of a sudden things changed. And it was the hot topic.
Stay nice and close into that microphone.
Okay.
Yeah, because you can turn it if you need to.
All righty.
So you can see us.
So you've been preaching this for years, so it must have been a real vindication all the time that you've been teaching this and advocating for 12-lead ECG acquisition and interpretation of the field and telling people this is not a difficult skill. Now suddenly it's getting the recognition it deserves. Have you found that a lot of people have come to you and said, Tim, I've been following you. You've been telling us this all along. I'm so excited.
Every once in a while, indeed, that does fact. Just on the way over here, I met a very nice lady, Dawn, and she said, gosh, we'd met like 15 years ago, and, you know, that kind of. So you're right. It's just a lot of, it's like the second paycheck. You know, you hear some of these stories, and like everybody else, I'm out here making a living, but I love what I do, and it's just great to hear that for some folks anyway, it seems to really be helpful to them, make a difference.
And one of the things that you've done, and I think this is kind of where we're going to go next, is you've transitioned that it's not always peer-to-peer, face-to-face education, but delivering training online. And, of course, this is an online podcast, and Rob teaches, and both of us do a lot of online education. And we're curious about just how, like, online education tools as well as social media tools can help spread a message even faster or, I guess, more consistently. As you've become an online educator, you know, what's sort of been the impact on the work that you do with the 12-lead ECG education?
Well, I'll certainly speak to the online part, but I have to admit, as far as the social media stuff goes, well, I need to learn as much as I can, okay, you know? But so a while back, you know, we've been doing the 12-lead classes, and obviously the limitation was is how many folks can be there on Tuesday at this time and whatnot. So for a long time, we've been looking at how to really do this. And when the broadband became more prevalent, obviously that was the opportunity. And so as we developed these and piloted them and tested them, one of my real questions was, how effective is this actually going to be? And I think at a minimum, I don't think anybody could dispute that at a minimum, you know, a blended learning approach combining classroom and online is certainly effective. But I have talked to a lot of folks that exclusively had done the online thing, and now here they are. I'm seeing them in a class, and they say, "Hey, I took that online class last year," you know. And I said, "Well, how did it go? You know, and what did you think? And what did you learn?" And so it's been, you know, certainly good feedback as well. But it's nice to kind of hear from them and say, okay, here's what I need to do next time." It is certainly a transit. I guess I make no claim to being the online expert, but what I say to people is, the difference between teaching in front of people and teaching online is sort of like adapting the novel and writing the screenplay for it. You know, it's the same content, but the format and approach are completely, completely different.
And when you say blended learning, do you teach in a blended learning fashion? Do you have courses where part of it is online and part of it is face-to-face?
And that is always an option. Now, most of the teaching that I do, it's a customer contacts me and says, "Hey, we'd love you to come do a class for our hospital or for our EMS agency or for our paramedic program or for this conference." So it's not always a setting that allows that. But, for example, the state of North Carolina had adopted the 12-lead program that we did, and like 3,500 paramedics went through it. And in addition to that, they sponsored probably a dozen 12-lead workshops, and the recommended approach was to do both, the workshop and the online. And so, because the good news was the online thing certainly was a good medium for a lot of what we're doing with this 12-lead and STEMI stuff, more so than maybe other topics or subjects, because some of it, at least anyway, is objective. And it was interesting. We ran this group through, and we had access, of course, to all their results, and not only like pass-fail, but we looked at all their learning objectives, and I was very surprised after 3,000-some-odd medics went through, 23 learning objectives, the one everyone struggled with the most was finding the J-point, which you would think would just be, you know, one of the more elementary, rudimentary things. And so from that feedback, I realized, wow, I've got to bump up that component in the workshop as well. And so it kind of goes both ways. You learn in the workshop, you try to put some of that online, you learn from online, you modify the workshop.
Now, tell us more about the online component. There's online that's text-based. There's online that's multimedia. What are you doing online?
Well, we attempted for the multimedia approach. And, you know, there's constant voiceover from my annoying voice and occasionally little videos of my mug being in there. But it kind of feels seamless. I might say, "Hi, here's what we're going to talk about. Hey, let me show you an EKG." So there's lots and lots of ECGs. It was done in Flash, so it's all dynamic. We have some of the concepts, to be honest with you. I am so glad I did this online thing, because otherwise I would have never gone through the effort of trying to get, you know, high-quality medical animations made. And once I made them for online, then I'm just stealing them all the time to use in the classroom. And so that has been one of the aspects that people respond to the most, is to take a concept that's maybe three-dimensional or spatial, and you try to explain it to them with words, and you try to explain it to them with static images, will get you so far. you have a three-dimensional animation. They go, of course. How could it be any other way? I got it instantly. And so that I think, is a big key.
Go ahead, Rob.
And how do you continue to engage them in the online component? Do you do a brief module, then there's a series of questions, and then you move on? How's that
right,
broken up?
Right. Well, the attempt was, now I can't say that we succeeded in this, but on my list of things I would love to do, my intention was to never go more than a minute without having them interact in some way, shape, or form. Huh. So it might be a quick little pop quiz. It might be, hey, let's do this exercise. It might be, hey, click on the tall peak, whatever. You know what I mean? And the attempt was to just always keep them engaged, always keep them interactive. And the other part is hopefully that we've whittled down the topic so much that it's in small bite-sized chunks, like 10-minute modules. So it's a five-hour program, but it's all in about 10-minute modules. So hopefully it works with attention spans and work schedules.
And is some of this online material downloadable? Can they download some of it to a mobile device, or is there like a video or an auditory component that's downloadable?
At present, there's not. I do have an iPhone app that's in the works, but that hasn't been released yet. So at present, it's hosted on the Physio Control University through CentralLearn, and it's a subscription basis.
And the app will be 99 cents. Is that right?
Well, I'm hoping free.
Seriously, wow.
So Physio Control University, powered by CentralLearn, that's the connection. And certainly of course, listeners know that I work for CentralLearn. But CentralLearn content, since it's web-based, people, anything that's got a browser, they can access it. Of course, Flash isn't supported on your iPad, natively at least, so therein lies some problems. But my Android phone, I can access CentralLearn content on and view Flash. But
You'll get there.
We'll have the arm wrestling later about iPad or...
There's no wrestling. You have to... You have to work for all devices.
You know, Tim, one of the things that Rob and I talk about quite a bit is because he's an educator in Canada. I'm in the United States. We've got listeners all over the world. And one of the things we wonder about is, as more education programs move online, is there opportunities for more consistent app implementation, I guess, partly in a state like North Carolina, but even between states or across borders, where we're sharing best practices more smoothly or easily. Am I capturing some of what we're talking about, Rob? And what are your thoughts on that, about specifically like with STEMI programs and the related education?
And now, so rephrase that one more time for me.
Maybe Rob's got to bail me out here, but just because we're not limited by just how far and how often is Tim willing to travel?
Oh, certainly. Right.
And so the content, we can have users in Europe, for example.
And everybody can get exactly the same program.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. So, and that's actually kind of significant. This I'll just use an example. Okay. The current guidelines specify a certain amount of ST elevation and certain leads. But by practice, some hospitals, agencies, regions can modify that a little bit, okay? And what becomes is that the assumption is sort of, oh, well, we do it this way locally, so I guess that's what the guidelines say.
Right.
And you kind of, you talk to these people, and they're questioning you. You're like, well, why aren't you consistent with the guidelines? And we go, well, I'm not sure. What do you mean? And you say, well, look at how much ST elevation you're talking about here. And I'm like, well, that's what the guidelines say. They go, they are? And so
Right. Without
even realizing it, there is – and diversity isn't bad. Standardization isn't always good. But you're right. Is it just in the dilution of things – that if you can, I guess the question is, can we settle on the content and the presentation that's suitable and appropriate and does everything we need to do? And if that has been settled on, then yeah, one of the huge advantages then is for that whole approach. And so, I mean, even we've had people from other countries that have been taking it, which surprised me because it's all in English, But folks from other countries have been taking it, and the European Resuscitation Council guidelines are virtually identical, not exact, but virtually identical to the AHA guidelines. So it absolutely is a worldwide audience, and the obviously, that affords individuals the opportunity to some content that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise if they were just dependent on what was being offered locally.
So the course we're talking about, is it specifically STEMI, or is STEMI a component of it?
Of the program?
Right.
Well, the program is STEMI-focused. And actually, and that's actually an interesting question. Because, we teach 12-lead ECGs, but I always tell people, we're not here to learn 12-lead ECGs. We're here to improve our STEMI care. And it's like the old story, hey, who owns a drill? Everybody in their hand raises a drill. Who actually needs their drill? Most people raise their hand and say, yeah, I need my drill. And we point out, well, you actually don't need a drill. What do you need? A hole. Okay, and a drill is just a means to an end. And we spend the day talking about 12 leads, but what we really try to emphasize is the 12 leads are just a means to an end. And that the goal is good STEMI care, and that you could be a really good EKG interpreter, you could have really good protocols, you could have great equipment, but at the end of the day, if all that didn't translate into treatment success, then we can't declare victory yet, okay? And I don't think this really answers everything that you are asking, but one of the things that I was surprised by was how important having the back-end data was going to be in terms of not just pass-fail, but individual performance on learning objectives, group performance on learning objectives, so that you could say, okay, to kind of speak to the whole thing of getting everybody up to the same level, if you sit in a class, check, they were here, check, they passed the test with an 80, check, see you in 2 years, okay?
Right.
And then, but what this gives you the opportunity to do, in addition to the class, is to go through it online, and there is no sitting there faking it. You know what I mean? You're answering yes, no, maybe, whatever, and you're getting immediate feedback. Then you have your entire system results in front of you, and you can say, well, you know, of these learning objectives, we seem to have mastered these over here, but holy cow, this is terrible. Look at it. And then you can just redirect people. They don't have to take the whole thing again, but you can just redirect them to the very specific little 10-minute modules that they need as a system to kind of get people up to that performance, and then at whatever prescribed interval, just kind of do a little reassessment.
With the few minutes that we have left on this episode of the EMS Educast, I'm wondering if we could just go back to the iPhone app, and maybe I don't know what details you're willing to release, but what are you hoping to accomplish with an app that you're not able to do with like a web-based education program?
Well, and the app is somewhat simple.
Okay.
This is sort of a low-tech analogy. It's like a digital set of pocket cards.
Okay.
But instead of having static information, it's got animations. Or you can just drill down to exactly what is. So there's, you know, people understand concepts. People know what they're supposed to be looking for. But, hey, we're human. How long does it take to forget 90% of anything anyway? And so the thought was, what were the criteria for suspecting STEMI in the presence of a left bundle branch block? And it's like, boom, boom. Oh, yeah, that's what it was. So it would function more as a digital set of pocket cards. But then the other aspect would be probably reinforcement, you know,
right,
wherever there was appropriate to have some animations and whatnot to explain. Oh, yeah, that's why. I'm a yeah, but guy. It's like, yeah, but why is it that way? And I know for my little pea brain, I can only remember things if I understand the reasons behind them.
Right.
So that's all we're trying to do. Give them the important cliff notes and let them drill down a little more for a little more explanation to jog their memory.
And Rob, I know you're real keen about how apps could play a role in education. What do you think some of the opportunities are for apps, whether it be initial or refresher or even that yeah, but education?
I think the key with the apps is to make them interactive. That's really what captures people's attentions. I think it's good to have a review. Some animations are definitely more engaging than text-based apps, and I have a few ECG apps on my iPad, and some have good information, but they're purely content-based. So I think it's great that you're doing animations. That's very good. And I think if you add some interactivity in those where they're actually touching the screen and moving things and measuring.
Angry Birds meets STEMI.
Angry Birds.
Yes.
That's
STEMI,
it. Exactly.
Like it.
Yeah, okay.
Just have someone who's pale, cool, diaphoretic, and throwing himself onto a PCI center. Balloon me now.
I'm calling the engineers as soon as we get done here. Okay.
Yeah. That would be a winner for sure. Tim, maybe if you could just have a final thought on topics we've touched on, and then we'll start wrapping up the show. Anything additional you want to add?
I guess the one of the challenges is kind of meeting the group's needs. You know, in any group, they're pretty diverse. Literally, not too long ago, I was teaching in a hospital, and we had not only EMT, we had EMT students, we had paramedic students, we had paramedics, we had nurses, we had physician assistants, and we had residents, all in the same group. And so I'm like, okay, you guys really set me up here, didn't you?
Right.
I've got to talk in such a way that the EMT basic understands what I'm saying, and I'm keeping this resident engaged for 8 hours. Okay. Yeah. And the other thing that I like about online is it's sort of, you know, the whole cafeteria plan. Take what you want, leave the rest behind. And so we're getting ready to release the advanced stuff, and a lot of people are ready for that, hungry for that, and you can kind of piecemeal it and just zoom in on the part that you're looking for.
Okay. And if a listener wants to connect with you to find out more either about the online courses that are available or, you know, the travels that you do for the peer-to-peer, face-to-face education.
You can ECG Solutions, S on the end, so ecgsolutions.com, or my email, tphalen, P-H-A-L-E-N, at mac.com.
Wonderful. Thanks, Tim, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Rob, let's start wrapping this thing up.
Sure.
People can reach me at my blog at paramedictutor.wordpress.com, and we encourage people to go to our Facebook page, and the address is?
Facebook.com/EMSEDUCAST. And before we go, Rob, maybe just your final thoughts on the EMS Today conference, where we've been broadcasting live from the Medtronic Foundation podcast studio.
Sure. Well, I've attended as many sessions as anyone could possibly attend in the last couple of days, and they've been very informative, very good. The show floor is incredible. I regret not bringing my camera to this, because, and I wish my students could see this. It's just incredible. Lining up to get in here was like lining up for Disney World and the opening of the park. It's just hundreds and hundreds of people, and an incredibly massive show with ambulances everywhere. Very impressive. Been a great show. My first one. Love it. Encourage people to come.
And I think you've just justified for yourself the reason you need to buy the iPad 2 is because it's got cameras. So you could, if you had the iPad 2, you could be walking around capturing those photos or even video, right?
That's true.
The case has been made. You just got to call home and talk to your wife. I'm sure there's an Apple store in Baltimore. Jamie Davis is here to help us. Well, again, listeners, it's been a real thrill to have you join us for the EMS Educast live at EMS Today, where today we're in the Medtronic Foundation podcast studio, and we also appreciate their support of this specific episode. We look forward to doing more live broadcasts at conferences around the country, and Rob, I'd even be willing to go to Canada, and maybe we could even go worldwide with this.
Well, you'll have to come to the NAMC conference in Canada in June.
Maybe.
Yeah.
We'll have to talk to them about getting us do live broadcasts. Listeners, again, you can connect with me personally if you'd like through CenterLearn. Maybe you could go to blog.centerlearn.com or look for me on Facebook, Twitter, etc. And always you can find past episodes of the EMS Educast at emseducast.com and connect with us on Facebook as well. Thanks again to the ProMed Network for hosting us. It's been a wonderful 2 days here at the EMS Today Conference.